Grace, the Amy Santiago of Royal Bloggers.
And I'm Jessica, the Dorothy Sporanath of Royal Bloggers.
And we'd like to welcome you to On Air, the podcast where two cynical Brits discuss the latest royal news and the truth behind the stories. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the On Air podcast. We had a bit of a change of plan, and we are going to be covering a recent health crisis in the British royal family. Shocking news story. We never covered that before. And we are going to look at the story that broke on Monday, which was that King Charles has been diagnosed with cancer.
I once again had like a flurry of messages from people saying, oh my God, with no context. And I had no idea what was going on. So as I've learned, I went onto Tumblr and I thought, well, they'll tell me what's going on. And I saw, well, the post about it. And I can't say what I thought because it's an expletive. It's also, it's like a compound expletive of both the S word and the F word. And I'm going to be honest with you, the vast majority of that response was because it was inconvenient for the podcast. Because, yeah, I was just like, we just recorded yesterday. I've already, like, I'm about halfway through editing it. I don't want to say I was annoyed at him because he can't help it and it's really bad, but I was annoyed at the universe for the timing of it.
Oh dear. I knew something was going to happen because I'd seen a lot of like news people say like special news at 6 p.m. today. Oh. So I was like, ooh. And in my head, I thought they're going to announce a general election for like Met. I thought they're going to announce it officially. I'd got home from school to take my bag and my coat upstairs. And then I came back downstairs. My mum and dad both went, who got cancer? And I heard that as Kate's got cancer. And I had my stomach dropped. I was like, what's going on? And I was looking at the TV and it wasn't going in, and they were talking about how the Prince of Wales has to step up, and I was like, this is not helping. And I was checking Twitter, and then I finally got to the breaking news update that said King Charles has been diagnosed with cancer, and I was just like, oh thank God. And then I went through, oh no, sorry Charles, I'm so sorry. I had to get through the emotions of just pure relief first, and then I was like, I've just told the world that he doesn't have cancer in the podcast multiple times. Oh no.
At the time of announcing it, it wasn't cancer. It was, you know, we didn't know that it was. Charles didn't know that it was. And so how could we have been expected to know? And I also think it wasn't as shocking because we had Kate's news, then Charles's news, and health in general has kind of dominated the discussions.
Yeah, I wasn't necessarily shocked that there was another health crisis. But yeah, I was a bit like, oh, okay. I wasn't exactly expecting that. And I definitely wasn't expecting cancer and, you know, it being like an actual thing. And you could tell that the press had not been prepared for this at all because they were very scrambly in the first day. They were like, Princess Margaret never had cancer, but she was ill once. So this is the official statement that came out at 6 p.m. on Monday, the 5th of February. And it says, during the King's recent hospital procedure for benign prostate enlargement, a separate issue of concern was noted. Subsequent diagnostic tests have identified a form of cancer. His Majesty has today commenced a schedule of regular treatments, during which time he has been advised by doctors to postpone public-facing duties. Throughout this period, His Majesty will continue to undertake state business and official paperwork as usual. The King is grateful to his medical team for their swift intervention, which was made possible thanks to his recent hospital procedure. He remains wholly positive about his treatment and looks forward to returning to full public duty as soon as possible. His Majesty has chosen to share his diagnosis to prevent speculation and in the hope it may assist public understanding for all those around the world who are affected by cancer. Ends.
Ends.
Got the classic ends at the end.
My favourite part of any statement, ends in big letters. We had some like little private briefings that they always do. They always release like a big statement and then the press come back for sort of clarification on things. And they're like, okay, well, we'll say this, but we're not going to actually say on record as such that it wasn't prostate cancer.
And that they were not going to tell us where it was.
Yes. So how does it compare to what he did last time? The first thing you notice, even before you actually read anything, is it's longer. So it's probably about twice the length of his first statement that he released about the fact that he was going in for prostate surgery. And can I just say, I feel vindicated by this.
I see that.
Yeah. Last time in the episode, I said that I thought, you know, Kate's statement was significantly longer, probably about the same length as the second statement from Charles. And Charles's statement was really short. And it was because Kate had all of this other stuff around it. And I think that I said that the difference I thought was in the purpose of the statements. So Kate's statement, they recognized that her as a young, healthy person having a major surgery was a big deal. And so they wanted to reassure us. Whereas with Charles at the time, it was something benign and normal, and he wasn't concerned about it, and his doctors weren't concerned about it. So it was just informing us. It didn't need to reassure us. And this statement, cancer immediately rings people's alarm bells of like, oh, well, I knew somebody who had cancer and they died. And so I think the statement was trying to reassure us this time. And so I feel vindicated that it was much longer because the purpose was different this time around.
Yeah, I think that's 100% accurate because the cancer word is just scary. And I think that's why I spent the whole of the last episode then having to get cut out, being like, it's not cancer. Just because it's, guys, come on, guys, it's not cancer. Just because you're all scared.
You
And
were
yeah,
right,
then I was,
though.
yeah, the last one was not cancer. This is a new thing, guys.
Yeah.
It's a new thing. I also think that I mentioned, and it was sadly lost to the new news, that they had to sort of clarify last time that it wasn't cancer because that's what everyone's brains would have jumped to, and everyone would have panicked, like more than they panicked anyway. So this time, when they had to say it was cancer, they needed to equally reassure people that it wasn't. Well, it wasn't, it's like death door, immediate termination kind of vibes.
That's an interesting way to talk about death, immediate termination.
I know, I was like, what's the correct phrasing here? And that's what came out. So that's what
Yeah.
I'm going with.
Yeah, so that was one of the big differences for me, was just even before you started reading it, was just the length of it. The other major difference was that it's more private this time around.
Yeah, like the phrasing form of cancer is just weird. Like, I'm sure they were just trying to find a way to say he's got cancer and trying to hint that it wasn't prostate cancer.
Yeah.
Because obviously that wasn't in the official statement, that was kind of clarified afterwards. But I was just like, what do you mean a form of cancer? Sounds like he's got some kind of like weird cancer variation. They didn't say what the type of cancer was, and they were also being very vague with things like, understandably, everything else. It was like he's having treatment, not telling you any more than that. We're not telling you where it is, not telling you when it is. We're not telling you how long he's going to be out for. So it's, ooh, it's a bit vaguer.
Yeah, and I think because the thing is, I'm fine with that. You know, it's kind of what we talked about last week of kind of they don't necessarily need to tell us the exact thing that's going on. They just need to tell us how it impacts us. Although I do think it's strange to say it's a form of cancer. We're not going, you know, and then point blank refuse to say what kind of cancer it is. Absolutely not going to tell you. And then say that they are sharing the diagnosis to prevent speculation and improve understanding. Cancer is a massive thing. There are so many different types of cancer. There are so many different stages of cancer, and there are different experiences that you'll have depending on what diagnosis you have. And so I really appreciate that, you know, they've since shared like really great resources for people who are going through cancer or family members of people who are going through it. And I really appreciate that. But I do just think that the statement itself, you can't really say like, we're going to obscure this to raise awareness. Like you can't, those two things don't really make sense.
I think the thing about cancer is it's so explanatory in some ways because if you say cancer, everyone knows what that means. They know you have to have some form of treatment. They know the risks. So people kind of accept vagueness in a way they wouldn't do if you were like abdominal surgery. Then everyone's like, I'm not sure I agree with this. I want to know more details. However, like you said, there are so many types of cancer, and within those types of cancer, they can be different stages and different grades and all of that, and the treatments can be different. Like and even what the treatments are can be given differently. Like chemotherapy could be sort of intravenous or through tablet form or anything. Not clarifying, but giving tidbits does invite speculation because people, including the national press, were there on national television speculating on what form of cancer it was and what treatment he was getting.
Yeah, exactly. They could have said something like, and I haven't thought about this, so it's not, you know, perfectly edited and, you know, a lovely, neat press statement, but they could have said something about how they were hoping that him talking about it would encourage other people to talk about their cancer diagnosis or would encourage conversation about cancer. Because I think that's a reasonable thing to be able to say that, you know, the king coming out and saying he had cancer would encourage more people to talk about their experiences with cancer. You know, there are people talking about, like, well, when I was trying to get treatment for cancer, it took me 18 months to get a diagnosis. And, you know, it has opened up a conversation about cancer care in this country. So I'd be totally fine if they said something along those lines. You know, I don't know any more about cancer because of Charles sharing that he has cancer than, you know, than I did before. I don't understand how it does increase understanding. So I think it's just, that's not how I would have phrased that last paragraph. It's just, you know, I'm absolutely fine with them sticking to the policy of privacy, but I think that they have to then accept that they have taken a policy of privacy.
Yeah, it's one of those moments. It's like, I kind of know what they meant, but what they said is not what they meant. I feel like they
Yes.
meant something more along the lines of, we hope by sharing this, other people will be able to come forward and talk about their experiences with cancer and all of that. But what they said is, we're going to help everyone. Thanks, guys. Thank us.
Yeah, definitely. And I have seen a lot of articles in the mainstream press as well, talking about this being like a test of Charles's policy. And that's everyone from the Times to the Guardian is writing those kinds of articles. So across the political spectrum. But I actually think, you know, it kind of goes back to some of the stuff we talked about last week. I think that's really oversimplifying everybody's approach in this, both the Queen's and Charles's, because, you know, we talked last week about the fact that the Queen's policy was wildly inconsistent, and they would either tell you everything that you needed to know, more than you even needed to know, or absolutely nothing at all. And I think the same with Charles. Like, I don't think that Charles's policy is, I am going to be open about everything. I think Charles's policy is, I'm going to tell people the things that they need to know. That I think it's much more pragmatic. Like, they couldn't tell us nothing because he is not going to be working for the foreseeable future. People would notice and would ask questions. And so they did, but they still held back what they weren't comfortable with sharing and what we don't actually need to know.
Yeah, and I also think there's a generational thing. Like, I know Charles is old, but he's 20 years younger than his mother was. My grandma likes to pretend nothing is going wrong. She's like, "No, I'm fine." And it's like, "Grandma, your toe is falling off here. Like, there's something wrong." She's like, "Nope, nothing's wrong." Whereas my aunts and uncles are a lot more like more open, but at the same time, they're like they keep little bits to themselves. Like, they might say, "Oh yeah, I need an operation." You're like, "What? What for?" You didn't give me any sort of more details. And then I think even then, if I sort of jump down to my cousins who are sort of in their 40s, so sort of William and Kate's age, they're more open again, but in different ways. And I think I can sort of see the comparisons between what the royals have done and the sort of they're matching members of my family and age-wise. And you know, they're not my family are not royals. They are not giving public statements on their health. But
They
even
should.
in as much as they sort of pass around the family or like put on Facebook, it's sort of very similar in how they give the news and the news they give. The through the statement and also through the kind of quiet asides they've made to the press since, they've given a lot of information and they just haven't given specifics. But I think, you know, you don't need specifics to know that someone he has cancer, he's getting treatment. We know kind of roughly some of the sort of treatment cycle and certain things about it. Like, I don't need to know any of that. All I need to know is that he's not on death's door, and at the moment, it's a positive outlook. Like, that covers it for me, really.
Yeah, exactly.
We were then getting a kind of look at the reaction from everyone to the news and look at some of the stories, let's say, that have arisen since. And we thought we'd start by looking at the kind of the press reaction and the public reaction because it was interesting because I'm just gonna set the scene. So news come out 6 o'clock Monday afternoon. They're about to do an hour and a half news show on BBC One, and for the next hour and a half, there is no other news. It is they are getting there was and also at the time the Prime Minister was in Ireland because Northern Ireland that morning had just re-brought back their cabinet for the first time in 2 years. So that was the morning story, and everyone was like, "Yep, Northern Ireland, we know where we're going with this politics." Charles was like, "No, I'm bringing my story." So everyone was in the wrong place. Normally, you get all the important politicians and political people in London, but they were all off in Northern Ireland. So they were talking to people, and people immediately jumped into stories like, "What is a councillor of state?"
I know this. I was actually, when I was thinking about it, I was like, you know what? We were just ahead of the curve in a lot of our conversations because all the things we talked about last week have become massive talking points this week.
I know. I watched this whole man on the news tell me that there are five councillors of state, and I was like, "Wrong, that's wrong. You're wrong." It's like you've forgotten Anne and Edward.
Yes,
They're
yes.
right. But yeah, so they immediately did that. Then they started calling up people who were like on their holidays because they weren't expecting any royal news. So you had like people like Nicholas Whittle phoning in from his holiday, being like, oh, it's really sad. And then as there was clearly no further news coming out, apart from, you know, we found out odd bits and pieces. We found out that obviously in the statement, it said that he'd already started treatment. And then they kind of said that he was an outpatient and he would be having the treatment in London and little bits like that, but nothing really sort of gritty to get anyone's teeth into. So the press and the public then immediately went to, so the king's going to die.
Yeah.
And that's it. And I always know the public reaction because I gather it from the children in my class.
Oh, I love that.
And I was just explaining to these little children why we were doing science in the morning because it had thrown their brains. And one of them put their hands up and just went, my mum says when the king dies, we're going to get another bank holiday. And I was like, well, if yes, possibly for a state funeral, we could get another bank holiday. And then all their little hands were up going, the king has cancer, so does that mean he's going to die? And my nanny had cancer and she died. Or my next door neighbour had cancer and she died, but my mum had cancer and she didn't die. And then we were going through it all, and I was like, and I was trying to reassure them and be like, well, just because someone has cancer, it doesn't mean it's a death sentence, but it also doesn't mean he's not going to die. It just means it's unlikely, but I can't say for sure. They're very positive about it. But yeah, we had a very long conversation about all of their relatives and friends and vaguely people they've ever met that have died of cancer.
See, the conversation in general is really not that different to the conversation that people have with children, because that sounds very similar to what everyone else has been saying.
Yeah, I just think it gives off, whenever the kids come into school, with, I'm like, that's what the public think, because that just brings me the full picture of it. And it was great, because you had one of them being like, it's a bit unfair that he gets treatment so fast, other people have to wait. And I was like, all right. Yeah. And then one was like, does that mean Prince William's going to be the king? I was like, okay, chill. Yeah, I was like, okay, this is just the political spectrum in my classroom.
Yeah, that's great. I love it. Yeah, I think with news like this, it's always a little bit like, well, I can tell you that my stomach drops when I see that the British royal family is trending on Tumblr. Because I know that it's just going to be a lot of people saying absolutely stupid things. I like my little corner where nobody bothers me and nobody knows I exist, except from the other people who care about the things that I care about. And everyone else just leaves us alone. But whenever they talk most about it, it's always just nuts. And, you know, it's the same in every platform, really, of like, you've got, on the one hand, you've got people who are kind of actively celebrating. And look, my view is, no one has to be sad. I cannot force anybody to be sad. And I don't feel like sadness in my, you know, in my gut. I intellectually know this is sad, but I don't know Charles. But then also, you don't have to publicly celebrate it. So there's, you know, there's that strain of things. But then there's also the other strain of things, which is just like, you know, there were parts of the week where, because Charles went to Sandringham after a few days after the diagnosis, and there were times where, you know, the press had sent people to stand outside Buckingham Palace, which is not where he was. He never is. He doesn't live there anyway. And they sent other people to go outside of the hospital where he also wasn't. So they were just people out in the, you know, instead of it being in the studio, they were out at places where Charles wasn't anyway to report on something in relation to Charles, talking about, like, you know, how strong he is, and you know, how the nation is weeping, and how people gathered in spontaneous groups outside of Buckingham Palace. It's like, there are always people outside of Buckingham Palace. It's a major tourist attraction. It gets very intense on all sides of the conversation.
Yeah, I had to kind of ban the conversation in my house because my mum and sister have turned into conspiracy theorists, and they're like, he's gonna die. I'm like, would you please stop? I can't. And they're not doing it like maliciously. Like, they're not celebrating it, but they're like, I think there's something more going on. I think, you know, they're hiding something, and, well, he's actually probably already dead and they've just not told us. Like, I can't actually have this argument with you because I'm going to get annoyed. And I didn't want to because it's a stupid thing to argue about, but you're wrong.
I mean, at least they're not saying it on social media.
So most of the time I just leave, like, royal news on, like, social media just to come through, and I sort of skim past it because either it's fine or it's stupid or it's silly, but I can ignore it. And then there's been a few times, like, after the Oprah interview, after The Crown, yeah, after the Queen died, and now after this, I'm like, I'm just going to mute any word I can think of related to royalty on every social media site, because not only does it bring out everyone who's like celebrating or being like, or just saying like bizarre things that I'm thinking, Actually, that's kind of more offensive to everyone else in the world that's ever had cancer than it is to the man you're trying to insult. But then it also brings out everyone who's also got conspiracy theories about anything else that's ever happened.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't need to know these. I've seen these. I don't need to see them again.
Exactly. And I think you're right. The main sort of conspiracy theory seems to be that Charles is on the brink of death. I get it. This idea that, Charles must be on the brink of death. He might be. They might be lying to us. He absolutely might be. It's totally possible. If they announce that next week, I don't want to be caught out. So I'm just going to say it's totally possible. And I get it because obviously it's not really that long ago that the Queen died. So we're in kind of death mode. But I think a lot of it comes from just like deliberately not paying attention to the information that's actually been released. People who are medical professionals as well saying things like, oh, well, it must be stage four. Because it wasn't prostate cancer. They confirmed it's not prostate cancer, but it was found during prostate surgery. And so, if it was found while they were investigating his prostate, then that means, but it's not prostate cancer, then that means that it's migrating, which means that it's stage four. So, it's very serious. But actually, the statement said that it was discovered during his recent hospital procedure, it was identified, and then subsequent diagnostic tests. So, what could have happened is that. While Charles was in hospital, he's a busy man, he probably doesn't have a lot of time for hospital appointments. While he was in there, they said, "Is there anything else that you're worried about?" And he went, "Oh, well, I'm also worried about this thing." And then they went, "Oh, okay, we'll get you some tests while you're here for that." Anything like this, there's a million and one different ways. Maybe it was something that came up that was abnormal during a blood test or something like that. He probably gets a whole, fancy suite of blood tests and things that we wouldn't get if we were going in for treatment ourselves in the NHS. So there's all sorts of different ways. And I do think they've been quite deliberate in the way that they have phrased the statement to make it clear that like it was found during his time, not necessarily during the surgery itself, and that it was a separate issue.
After news breaks, it doesn't have to be ruined, it could be any news. Like the professionals who come out, who probably are medical professionals. And I'm like, this just feels very unethical to me to come out and then be like, I'm just going to give my personal opinion on this person's medical history that I don't know. And it's the same, like lawyers do it sometimes. And, I'm sure people do it from all sorts of professions. And I'm like, I would therefore no longer trust you personally
Yeah,
with
yeah.
me if I was in a medical emergency because
Yeah.
it happens all the time. And I'm like, you don't. Like, I know that I don't know what is going on in like the classroom next to me at school. Like, I wouldn't call myself an expert on these children I see every day and teach twice a week, let alone another person's medical history, who probably has fairly private medical history. Just gonna suggest as being the king and all that. So it's bizarre to me, really.
The whole tone of a lot of the conversation is it's a lot of speculating, and I think it's quite dangerous to be speculating about people's health in general. It makes me uncomfortable. I don't think it's very nice, but I also think it's just quite dangerous.
Yeah, I think, there's always those whenever like someone famous gets ill, there's always that little person on Twitter or something who gets like, the person you're making the jokes about won't see this, but your friends and family will. But like, it's true. Like, if you are making jokes saying, I don't know, that Charles got cancer for killing his wife or whatever you're saying, someone out there with cancer is going to be like, so you're saying cancer is a punishment.
Yes,
And
exactly.
you're always, that's what the assumption is. You're saying that because Charles has done this thing wrong, he's got cancer, which it's not fair and it's not true and it's not fair. And all the millions of other people in the world who've got cancer or and have got who haven't done anything wrong, or the people in the world who have done things wrong and are living perfectly healthy lives, it's not how biology works. So it's not true.
I was just going to say, I also think it's completely pointless. Health is such an odd thing. Like I was thinking about the example in Sweden of Prince Daniel. So Prince Daniel is married to Crown Princess Victoria, if you don't know. And in 2009, he got a kidney transplant from his father. From a He'd had a congenital kidney disease and he'd known about it for a very long time, but it had been manageable for a very long time. And in February, I think it was, of 2009, they announced their engagement. And he looked really healthy. He's a guy who runs a chain of gyms. He's that committed to going to the gym that he made it his job. Like that's an extra level of commitment to fitness. So he was an incredibly fit guy. Within 6 weeks of that press conference, his kidney had failed. He needed a transplant and he was on dialysis to keep him alive. So I think, anybody can be hit by a health crisis and it can happen very, very quickly.
I also think, and I'm not saying like, oh, you should listen to our podcast because we know everything, because we don't. I do actually do a fair bit of research for the podcast, but I think a lot of the speculation comes from just not understanding how things work. And when I don't understand how things work, I just don't talk about them.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
I do not understand American politics. And I've tried. I sit there and I try and figure out the different houses and all of that. And I learn enough to understand, like, election news. And then I forget it or have to relearn it. And I can never talk about it. I can never tell you, like, who's going to win the election based on the primaries, because I don't really know what a primary is.
Yeah, no.
I just know they happen. But, like, you know, when I said this, one of my, having my mini arguments with my mum, and she was like, well, I think he's actually dying because it's secret. And I was like, well, he's not doing any public engagements. And I was like, well, he's probably not doing any public engagements because people with cancer are often, you know, at a higher risk of infection due to the treatment they get. And he is doing work at home. And if he is at death's door, he's probably not going to be, you know, meeting the prime minister and signing laws.
Yeah.
Like, that's probably, you'd probably take some time off. And they've not installed the councillors of state or even a temporary regency. So to me, logically, he's not at death's door because he's still literally working. And I feel like if you're going to die, you get some time off work. I understand the, like, the frenzy, especially because it's a story where there's a story at the beginning and the story is the announcement, and then there is nothing, like, until the for Charles it's either going to be an all clear or a death, but, you know, for time is the baby or the wedding. There's this whole period of time where you get occasional updates and a lot of speculation, and, you know, we can see that with anybody, you know, like, oh, where's the baby going to be born? Is it a boy or a girl? She's wearing blue. It must be a boy. Who's going to be her birthing partner? How is she going to, is it going to be a quiet labor? Is she going to do hypnobirthing? And all of the things that you do for a baby or a wedding, the same things are happening. People are like, oh, he's having chemotherapy. He's not having chemotherapy. He's having potions. He's, you know, he's recuperating in Sandringham. He's being treated in Sandringham. He's in Sandringham because he's having hospice care. You know, it's the same speculation. It's just negative by what it's about rather than positive.
Yeah, that's actually another talking point, is sort of I've had a couple of people mention to me, like, oh, I thought Charles was really into homeopathy and that was alternative medicine, and I'm really surprised that he's doing chemotherapy or some form of, you know, medical treatment. And it's like, but the issue was identified while he was in a medical hospital getting medical treatment for something else. Why is it a surprise to you that he would be getting medical treatment for cancer? Like, he probably will also eat green vegetables and rub some crystals or whatever it is he does as part of his homeopathy. He probably will do that in parallel, but he's always said that his homeopathy stuff is done in parallel.
Yeah, I was some minorly, I thought they were an American royal reporter on TV in America was like, Charles isn't having chemotherapy, he's having potions. And that became like this whole thing on social media, which didn't particularly bother me, that one, because I was like, fair enough, that's quite a funny thing to say, King Charles is having potions, you do you. But like, when I'm ill, I have orange juice because I know vitamin C's in it and that's good for you. But also I have paracetamol because that's got medicine in it.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you can do both. That's one of the few things they've actually not hidden. It's not like, oh, he might have treatment at some point. They're like, yeah, he had treatment that started today.
Yeah.
So we know he's having treatment. This is one of the things where they actually were quite open.
Yeah.
So I don't quite know where this story's come from.
Yeah.
The other group of people who reacted to the news are the royals in general, but specifically the British royals, because they're kind of the only ones that said anything apart from, like, Prince Albert, who was like, sucks to be you, Charles.
That was the official statement, yeah.
So, obviously, we found out via the press, the within mere minutes of the news breaking, we heard that Prince Harry was coming to the UK. The press were thrilled because they had a whole new angle to go with, which was Prince Harry's coming to reunite with his family and move back to the UK and do real work. Or the alternative, which was Prince Harry's come to give his dad cancer because he's about to die. So yeah, Prince Harry flew to the UK the next day, so on Tuesday. He arrived, he went in a car to Clarence House, which is where the King and Camilla were. He was there for 35 minutes. Charles and Camilla went to Sandringham and Harry went to a hotel and then he went home. So it was like the biggest non-story of all time.
The main schools have been like, this is a bridge to reconciliation. And then other people being like, oh, it was only, you know, it was less than an hour. It was actually really inconvenient for Charles because he wanted to go to Sandringham and Harry was delaying him. I don't care. It's none of my business what their private relationship is as father and son. It's none of my business whether Charles asked Harry to come over. The only thing that I would feel is my business, I guess, or is relevant, is the fact that the consequence of Harry flying over is that it did cause some people to lean into this notion of, oh, well, Charles is on death's door. Doesn't mean that Harry shouldn't have gone or that Charles didn't want him there or anything like that, but that has been the kind of narrative that a lot of people have spun from Harry's visit.
That was my mum's narrative. She was like, "Why is Harry here then?" And I was like, "Well, maybe he doesn't see his dad who has cancer. Maybe." I can spin it either way. Like, I can make both arguments. But I mean, like you said, I'm not Harry or Charles. Therefore, I don't know why he was there. And I think it is very unlikely, unless anyone seems to release another tell-all book, that we're ever going to know why anyone was there. So, not much I can say about it.
If I think of my own example, my grandmother had a few really big strokes. I have not had to, not to get into a therapy session, but do not have the best relationship with my grandmother before this happened. And yet my mum and I went up to Aberdeen, which is where I'm originally from. And so I was traveling from London, my mum was traveling from Spain, and we went up to Aberdeen to see my grandmother in the hospital. And 5 and a half years later, she's still alive. She's not in a good way, but she is still very much alive. And actually, my granddad is dead. And we had no idea 5 and a half years ago that my grandfather would have been dead. So, I think the fact that we went up was an indication of the fact that what she had going on was serious and that we felt we should, but she did not die. And we didn't know whether or not she would die. We didn't go up there because anyone had told us she's going to die.
It was a 35-minute meeting. Like, I teach science lessons for longer than that. It was short. It was so short. Like, I was on my lunch break and I went on BBC News and I saw that it was like Prince Harry's touchdown in the UK. And I was like, oh, that's nice. And then by the time I checked again after the end of the day, I was like, King Charles is in Sandringham. And I was like, what? Harry's only just got here. Charles didn't feel the need to extend his stay in London with Harry. Clearly, they were happy. And also, Harry didn't feel the need to extend his stay in London any longer. He went back to California the next day. So, for me, that just proves that he's not at death's door because Harry would otherwise still be here ready for the funeral.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point.
The next kind of royal to touch on it was on the cancer diagnosis, was William, who managed to do it in like the most minor way possible.
Most William way possible, yeah.
Yeah, the most William way possible. So the more Wednesday morning, so the morning after the Harry and Charles meeting, he was out and about for the first time since early January. And he did investitures that morning, and people had said, were saying in the investiture, like, oh, we're sorry about Kate and your dad. And he was like, thank you so much, which is, just what you do. It's their day. Don't want to be like, oh, it's been such a hard time. I'm so stressed, honestly.
Yeah.
And then that evening, he had some air ambulance dinner thing. And he gave a speech, and at the start of that speech, he said, "Thank you for all the kind messages about Kate and my father, especially in recent days." And then immediately made a joke, was like, "And after this medical gossip of the last few days, I thought I'd come to the air ambulance," ha, and moved on with his life, which is a very William way to approach things.
Yes. Yeah, no, I liked it. It was very William. Wait, it wasn't a joke about Charles's cancer. It was a joke about like, oh, we know that there's loads of health news that's been going on. It's not just you, the public, who's been barraged with all of this health related stuff from us. We also understand that that's how it feels for us, sort of thing. It was good to address it head on and in a positive way.
Yeah, I think particularly for William, I think because we hadn't seen him or Kate since Kate had gone to hospital, there was already this real anticipation of William coming back. So people could go, how's Kate doing? And then obviously 3 days or 2 days before that, his dad got diagnosed with cancer. So they were like, okay, which bit do we ask about first? I think he managed to sort of reassure people, but be like, okay, and now we're just going to move on from this conversation. And then the day after that, so they spread these out quite nicely, it was quite helpful for them. Was the Queen, so Queen Camilla, went to a cathedral.
Oh, it was Salisbury. Isn't that the
Salisbury.
one where they had the poisonings?
Yeah, it is. The poisoning cathedral.
A Russian poisoning that and the when the people who were Russian who were caught who'd done it were asked about it, they were like, oh no, we were in Salisbury to see the cathedral.
You're just visiting La National Landmark. But yeah,
Anyway,
the
sorry.
Queen went to the Salisbury Cathedral.
Wasn't poisoned.
Yeah, no one was poisoned. It was a little charity concert thing. And they obviously the press like, how's Charles doing? And everyone's going, how's Charles doing? And the people in there were going, how's Charles doing? So she was like, oh, he's doing extremely well. We're really touched by all your letters and messages. He's doing great. Which just gave me flashbacks to when, you know, when George or Charlotte or Lou was born, or when Archie was born, or Lily, or when the engagements are announced. And they go like to Princess Anne, like, how are you excited about your new great niece? And she's like,
nothing to do with me.
nothing to do with me. Not really. Or they go to like William, like, are you excited about, you know, your nephew? And he's like, yeah, I've already got a nephew, but yeah, this one sounds great too. Yeah. And they're just like, it's fine. I'm not going to give you a breaking news press release in a comment. They're like, nope, yep, everything's fine. We're thanks. Move
yeah,
on.
Exactly. It wasn't groundbreaking to say he's doing well and thank you for being nice to me. Like, that's exactly what Charles's statement said, pretty much. I think she's a really good person to handle this situation, because I think if I was already a little bit emotionally tense, because it would be emotionally tense, you know, to kind of have your partner going through cancer, if somebody was then trying to ask me about it, I'd be like, I'm not in the mood to be, I don't even want to be here, I want to be at home, why do I have to answer your questions? But Camilla just answers things very well. She's very sort of, she understands that the press have a job to do, and that's why they're there, and that's why they're asking, and you know, the public are interested, and that's why they're asking. It's not rude. She understands that, but she also understands where to draw the boundaries and where to draw the limits, and not giving away information that Charles would be uncomfortable with her giving away. So she is really the right person to be doing a lot of this kind of, you know, public facing response to Charles's situation.
Sort of, I think unintentionally they managed to do all these things across 3 days. And so by the end of the week, the narrative was essentially, he's fine.
Yeah.
He's got cancer, but he's fine.
It feels to me like everyone calmed down a lot more quickly after the cancer diagnosis than they did after the first situation when the Kate and Charles's stuff was announced. I guess because like it's a longer term situation. It's very serious, but okay, well, we can't freak out about this every single day for the next 9 months. We've got to pace it out a little bit.
And just the last thing is that Charles then released another statement from him, which was kind of like a weird thank you statement, which said, I would like to express my most heartfelt thanks for all the messages of support and good wishes I have received in recent days. All those who have been affected by cancer will know such kind thoughts are the greatest comfort and encouragement. It is equally heartening to hear how sharing my own diagnosis has helped promote public understanding and shine a light on the work of all those organisations which support cancer patients and their families across the UK and the wider world. My lifelong admiration for their tireless care and dedication is all the greater as a result of my own personal experience. It reminded me a lot of his statement when he kind of be like, I'm so glad me sharing my enlarged prostate's helped you all.
Yeah.
It gave me the similar vibes. But I also think it was a good way to be like, it was nearly a week after the announcement, showed he was still functional enough to get someone to write a statement for him and put an auto pen signature at the bottom. And I think it's given sort of, it's been able to sort of move everyone on a bit so they don't have to, he's dying. We know he's alive. He's saying thank you. He's having treatment.
Yes. Yeah. So we are moving on to a slightly different topic. On the 3rd of February, a man called Prince Vittorio Emmanuel has died at the age of 86. And you're probably thinking to yourself, who is Vittorio Emmanuel and why should I care? And you would be right. Those are valid questions. But I would like you to buckle up as we talk about probably the main scandal of Vittorio Emmanuel's life and the sort of twisty, it's a very twisty, turny kind of scandal. I loved researching this, I'm just going to say. If it's scandal or corruption or anything like that, which this story has got in spades, then I am happy to read about it.
Yeah, I've got to say, I've never really read a court transcript before, but I was right into them for this. I was like, whoa, twist again. It's great though.
Yeah, I watched a 3-part documentary. Yeah, so I mean, we're going to be talking about one specific scandal from Vittorio Emmanuel. So let's just dive into a little bit about his background and who he is before we kind of kick off. Vittorio was the only son of King Umberto II, who was the last king of Italy. During the war, Vittorio Emmanuel's grandfather, Victor Emmanuel, I don't know why we anglicised that and not Vittorio Emmanuel, because it's the same name, surely. But we do. Anyway, Victor Emmanuel, he was very close to the fascist government under Mussolini, and he signed what are called the racial laws, which are very controversial in Italian history and essentially kind of enforce discrimination, segregation, as we've talked about in our abdication episodes recently, to kind of keep the throne going. He left and handed the throne to his son Umberto, but the monarchy was already so unpopular that a month after Umberto took the throne, he was removed after the Italians had a referendum to decide whether they wanted to be a republic or a monarchy. And so at 8 years old, Vittorio and his was sent into exile along with his family. This happened in 1946. So yeah, that's a little bit of the background of their story. And he kind of had this lifelong bitterness about the fact that he said he didn't, but he did. This lifelong bitterness about the fact that they had been forced out of Italy. But I would just like to say, you might sound like, oh, you know, this is really unfair that this poor little boy who was only 8 years old got kicked out of his country and was never allowed to go back. But don't feel too sorry for them. Because, I mean, they ended up living in Geneva. They were multimillionaires. There were friends. These people were not hard done by. They were just, you know, I'm not trying to undermine that it was probably very difficult for them to not be able to go back home. But I would be quite happy to leave the UK forever if somebody made me a multimillionaire.
Yeah, just look at pictures, it's fine.
Another sort of slightly interesting story. It's a bit strange that I'm mentioning this story, but once I get a bit further in, people will understand why I've talked about it. So just, it'll seem odd, but keep it in your mind. In 1956, Vittorio Emmanuel was about 19 years old, I think. He was with King Juan Carlos of Spain. He obviously wasn't king at the time, he was just Juan Carlos, but he was with him. Juan Carlos was 18. And I think we might have talked about this in our Spanish episode, but I can't quite remember because it was like our second episode. We fell in love over an oil spill. Juan Carlos shot and killed his brother, and it was all sort of quite hushed up. And Vittorio Emmanuel was there at the time that it happened and saw the whole fallout and saw the way that it was all handled. And so that sounds like a strange thing that I am bringing up, but just keep it in the back of your head that this happened to Vittorio when he was about 19 years old, because it will be shockingly relevant later on. It
It'll pop up again later.
will pop up later, yes. Yeah, so that's a little bit of a background about why we're talking about Vittorio, because we knew we were going to be talking about Charles as well. We decided not to do an entire episode on somebody no one has ever heard of. And so we're going to be focusing on one specific scandal that happened to Vittorio. But I just want to briefly mention the fact that he was also accused of anti-Semitism. He also has a rivalry with another pretender to the Italian throne and very famously punched him in the face at Felipe and Letizia's wedding. If punching someone at a royal wedding isn't even close to the most dramatic thing you've done, then you know that that person is a pretty dramatic person. So yeah, I was thinking of this as like the biggest royal scandal you've never heard of. That's how I'd pitch it.
Yeah, I think that works because it is one of those things where it's like it's not in the public domain. When people talk about royals, they never, ever, ever bring this up as like an example of royals doing weird things. But it's also easily the biggest scandal I've ever seen.
The Brits get a reputation for being the most scandalous family and having so many dramas. But I think that, you know, one of the things I'd like people to take away from this podcast is that that is wrong. Every one of the royals is messy. And actually, the Brits are just the most famous messy ones.
Yeah, they're I always think that. Like whenever I look at other royal families, I'm like, hang on, I feel like Britain just get away. Just they're not that they've never done anything wrong, but they're often like the scapegoats because everyone knows who they are and they speak English.
So we are going to be talking about the death of a man named Dirk Hammer. So the story starts in August of 1978 on the 17th in the small French island of Cavallo, which is between Corsica and Sardinia. There was a group of rich, hot, young Italians who rented three boats to go from Sardinia and spend the day at Cavallo. And just as an aside, I watched a documentary about this whole situation. Every single person in this story, except from Vittorio, probably, is the most gorgeous person you've ever seen. Yeah, it's not relevant really to the story. I don't I like I don't know. Just wealth does make you more attractive. I don't know.
I think it does to an extent because I'm
Yeah.
like, ooh, rich. But
Maybe just
yeah.
attractive people attract other attractive people.
Yeah, and go to the Mediterranean on private islands. Maybe that's just where you need to find them.
But anyway, that was just a random aside. So yes, there was this group of about 25 to 30 rich, hot young Italians rented these boats to go to Cavallo. But one of the group was a woman named Brigitte Hammer. Her dad told her that she could only go on this trip with this group of people if she took her brother with her, who was 19 years old, and his name was Dirk Hammer. Cavallo is where Vittorio and his family had a holiday home, and so they were there at the time. And the young group of young people said that they'd met Vittorio a few times throughout the day, like he'd sailed past their boat, and he'd been quite aggressive towards them, they say. So yeah, they were being loud and boisterous and having fun. And apparently Vittorio saw them a few times throughout the day and was slightly irritated by them.
Bit understandable.
Yeah.
Sound rich people.
I've lived in London. I've been on the tube during large groups of school trips. They're loud and annoying. I didn't take the actions that Vittorio did, but that's to come. So they'd been having this lovely day, and then the weather got really, really bad, and so they couldn't sail back to Sardinia. But they had no food on their boats because they hadn't been expecting to stay, and they had no way of getting to the island, which is had one restaurant. It's the only place they could have had food. So they decided to try and get to the island. They would just steal a dinghy. And what they didn't know at the time was that the dinghy belonged to Vittorio Emanuele's son, Emanuele Filiberto. They left and went to bed on the boats about 11:30 p.m. ish, left the dinghy moored next to one of their boats. Vittorio, upon leaving the restaurant, noticed that his son's dinghy was attached to their boat. So he decided to go to his home, pick up a military-grade rifle, get on one of his boats, and sail out to the boats that were owned by the Italian group where the dinghy was. And then this is where it gets a little bit contentious. So there are multiple different accounts of what actually happened on the boat, and none of us were there, so we don't know. The main differences in the story tend to be in sort of, I suppose, around the intention of Vittorio and kind of his behavior. So the Italians say that he was much more aggressive than Vittorio does. And so I think that the best sort of account of the event is one that was provided by a French court in 1996. And this was part of a separate court thing, court case, that's the word, that happened, that was part of that, over the years. And what they said was that Vittorio pulled up his boat next to the three boats that were moored from the Italian group. Nicky Pendi, who was one of the people on the boat, was w woken up by the sound of Vittorio pulling his boat up. Came out onto the front of the boat. Vittorio then got onto the Italian's boat that Nicky was on to sort of confront Nicky for stealing the dinghy. He fired his gun twice. Nicky managed to avoid the shots, threw himself on Vittorio because he was carrying a gun, and they fell in the water together. But one of the bullets that they hadn't realized, kind of kept going, and it hit the femoral artery of Dirk Hammer, who was sleeping, who had his leg sticking out. That's why it hit his femoral artery. And he got taken to hospital, but unfortunately, he died in December of 1978. So, it is a contentious thing. I think that's the account that seems closest to reality.
Yeah, I think it's very much, I would say, devoid of emotion because it's emotional by its nature of what happened, but it's not, it's very factual. It's like this happened. We know these certain things happened.
Yeah, so I mean, not to ask you to speculate, none of us were there, obviously, but what do you think of that whole situation? Just taking it as it is there with none of the other stuff that we know that happens later on.
You can understand Vittorio's frustration with why his dinghy's been stolen. You can understand him being very upset about that. He then made the decision to go and get a military grade rifle with 31 rounds of ammunition, which is a choice that had to have been made for a purpose. So whether that purpose was to shoot or to hurt someone or just to scare someone, like we can't know what was going on in his head at that precise second. But we know he went to get the gun and went over to the boat and made the effort. He went all the way out in his own boat to get to that boat. I think, and we know he fired the shots because two shots were fired. And we know they fell in the water because they were both wet, as you are. And it's one of those things where it is a completely horrendous accident in a way. He's asleep, he's got his leg sticking out, which you should never do, clearly. It's hard to say it's an accident because someone had a gun and shot someone, whether or not it was intentional, but in all versions of the story, like Dirk was never like an intended target. It was he, no one set out to the boat to shoot Dirk. They set out to do something else. And he obviously, and it was a really horrendous injury. And I imagine for the people there at the time, you know, it would have been the most horrifying thing to see, because, you know, famously your femoral artery is the big important artery that keeps you alive, because it's where your most of your blood pressure is. And you know, you can see from some of the kind of surgery that Dirk went through, I mean, he had 19 surgeries, his leg ended up being amputated to try and save his life. Like, that's not a teenage, and obviously he did eventually die after being in a coma for 4 months.
Yeah.
So it was a really sort of horrendous, long, drawn out death, not a nice, quick, in and out type thing.
My temptation when I was first writing my notes was to kind of go through this all forensically. So I was like literally writing out a timeline of like, well, this happened at this time, and this is what this person says happens, and this. And then I took a moment and I was like, I actually don't think you need to do this. Yes, they stole the dinghy, and they probably were loud and annoying. But as I said, I've seen lots of loud and annoying tourists on the tube, and I've lived with people who've stolen my milk from the fridge. I didn't kill anyone. I think, first of all, this all happened at about midnight. So it's very possible that Vittorio could have seen the dinghy, been really annoyed, but gone home and left it until the morning. He could have made that choice, and he chose to go in the heat of the moment when he was really, really angry instead of leaving it. He could have chosen not to go home and pick up a gun. Even if he'd gone home and picked up the gun and decided to sail with it, he could have chosen to not pick the gun up once he was next to their boat. You don't carry a gun. And maybe this is a very British attitude, and some of the people who come from other countries where guns are more normalised will feel differently. But as far as I'm concerned, you do not pick up a gun and take it to a situation where you anticipate you're going to be in conflict with somebody. Or even actually, you don't pick up a gun at all unless you anticipate that somebody could get shot.
I was trying to come at it from not the view of a British person. I don't know what the attitude to gun crime was in the 70s in tiny private islands in the Mediterranean. When he got on that boat, even if a great big man walked towards him, the man who walked towards him did not have a gun. So he still fired a gun at an unarmed man.
Yeah, there is a fine line between going out intending something and making careless choices, knowing that it could lead to that thing. Like, how much of a difference is there really between going out aiming to shoot somebody and kill somebody and going out knowing that you've made all of these choices that could lead to somebody being shot? Like, what is really the difference there, you know?
Yeah. I think that's what's going to come up a lot in the court discussions.
Yes. So what happened immediately afterwards was that Vittorio was charged with assault, occasioning bodily harm, and possessing and carrying a weapon. Initially, his request for parole was denied, and he always says, like, it was the most horrible thing. I was so terrified to be in prison. It was so unfair. But also, I wasn't kept with all of the other inmates, and I got to sunbathe, and they cooked veal for me. And it's like, can you make up your mind whether or not this was a real hardship, or whether or not you got treated so much better than everybody else? Because he does this a lot. But anyway, yeah, his time in prison doesn't seem like it was particularly traumatic.
Yeah, I mean, if I could go to a prison where I got meals cooked for me and I was kept safe and also could sunbathe, honestly, it sounds like a nice holiday.
Yeah, I didn't have to be with all the other prisoners. Yeah, and then so during this time, he signed a statement where he took liability for his role in the shooting. And when he was asked about that later on, he said that it was because he hadn't meant to kill Dirk, but he accepted that he had fired the shot that killed Dirk. He also paid the Hammer family 500,000 francs about 3 weeks after the shooting. And this was to cover their son's medical expenses, because at the time they didn't know whether or not he would survive. He was going through lots of very expensive treatments. And so I think initially, in the first couple of months, it seemed like Vittoria wanted to take responsibility for what he'd done.
Yeah, I agree. I think he did sign. He agreed. He had civil liberty. He was like, I did civil liability. He was like, I did, in fact, do that. I think, you know, when I saw it was 500,000 francs, I was like, that doesn't sound like very much. And I checked what that would be in like today's euros. And I was like, okay, 1.5 million is a fair chunk of money. I see that one. I'll let him off. And I think when you look at the sort of police report from the time, they were very much like, and when Dirk wakes up, we'll talk to him about it. So at this point, I don't think they assumed he would die.
Yeah, definitely. After he got out of prison, things started to shift. The Hammer family in particular started to become quite suspicious because, as far as they could see, there weren't any investigations happening. So there were some people who were on the boat that night who said they were never interviewed by anybody at all. There was lots of slightly suspicious things that happened. So, for example, one of the judges who was supposed to be involved in the case was randomly transferred to Tahiti overnight.
As
Lucky.
you do.
A lucky guy. I would love to be transferred to Tahiti. Actually, I don't know anything about Tahiti. It just sounds very glamorous and exotic. Emmanuel, the Savoy camp, started coming out with defenses. So there were a few different things. One of them was Vittorio's wife, Marina, who was very vocal throughout this, who said that the Hammer family were only doing it for money. The Hammer family accepted money, but they said that they stopped asking for money as soon as their son died because it had initially been intended for his sort of fund to help him in his life because of all of the procedures that he'd had to have and the disability that he might have. But I think regardless, they didn't plan the shooting in order to get money from the Savoy family.
Yeah, like they didn't do the shooting, they didn't bring
Yeah,
the gun.
exactly.
It's like people get compensation all the time
Yeah.
for things where, like, for being hurt.
One of the other things that they said was that his death was kind of avoidable and that it was a result of choices made by Dirk Hammer's father. Initially, Dirk was in a sort of small local hospital. He was then moved to Marseille and then he was moved to a hospital in Germany. And the move between Marseille and Germany was, according to the French court in their sort of neutral statements, was done against medical advice. And Dirk's father was a very controversial doctor. He had his medical license revoked in 1986. He was charged with malpractice because he had denied a child access to chemotherapy. The Savoy family and Vittorio and his wife sort of implied that the death was actually a result of the father making terrible medical decisions for his son. And they questioned the autopsy, which had found that he was killed by the gunshot wound. So, I mean, I don't know. I wasn't there. I don't know how involved his father was in making the decision.
He wouldn't have been in the medical trauma in the first place if he hadn't been shot. So even if he may perhaps maybe he wouldn't have died, which we don't know, he still could have died if he stayed where he was in Marseille. But he wouldn't have been in there at all if he had not been shot in the leg.
The last sort of big talking point, which was also something that became very relevant in sort of later court cases, was someone else shot Dirk and then escaped. This theory really came about because there was another gun on board the boat, which belonged to one of the passengers. And after the shooting happened on the island, the warden of the island, who was obviously quite friendly with Vittorio, it was not a police officer, he was just the guy who looked after the island. He went to the boat and he found a gun in a drawer, and there were two bullets that were missing from this gun. Obviously, the problem with that is there was no sort of clear chain of custody, I guess, of like the police didn't find the gun. We have no idea when those two bullets were fired. And it's slightly implausible that somebody would have appeared unnoticed, stand in exactly the same spot as Vittorio, shoot the same angle that he'd shot, and then disappear, and nobody witnessed anything. It's a stupid argument.
And also that he hadn't mentioned it at any point prior to this moment.
Yes,
Yeah, like
exactly.
even if that man had been there and it was someone else and it was like a massive Italian conspiracy to get Vittorio Emmanuel in prison, like he had at that point had several months where he was going like, yeah, it was me actually. I did in fact fire the shots.
It's all ludicrous. However, I will say, even if he did it, Vittorio is not under any obligation to claim guilt. He doesn't have to, nobody who is accused of a crime has to say they're guilty if they are guilty. Because imagine if the justice system would be great if you were guilty, you had to say you were guilty, and if you were innocent, you had to say you're innocent. We'd never have any trials because we'd all just
All
know.
the lawyers would be out of a job. They wouldn't know what
Exactly.
to do with themselves.
Exactly. So, you're under no obligation. And once he got the services of a lawyer is bound by the obligation to put forward the best possible defense. And the best defense is not just poking holes in what the other side have said, it's coming up with an alternative. I've watched enough crime shows to know this. I can understand why it might seem unfair But also, if I was in that situation, I would want my lawyer to put forward the best defense possible.
Yeah, it's like the whole point of, when you find someone guilty, you're supposed to find them guilty beyond reasonable doubt. Because if there is the slightest chance it wasn't them, you have to assume they didn't do it. And inventing another person that did it is a great way to do reasonable doubt. It's like, yeah, but what about the other guy?
Yeah, definitely. I do think that, I was trying to be really open, and so that's my, I wrote that down when I was writing this documentary. But then immediately his legal team annoyed me because his lawyer did this really bizarre press conference where he talked about how Victoria was the first royal to be imprisoned since Marie Antoinette. So his argument was essentially, without saying it, like, I'm being targeted because I'm royal. I was like, oh my goodness, you're not even a real royal anymore, mate.
He's being like, this is actually a conspiracy against me as this incredibly important political figure, like Marie Antoinette. And it's like, actually, the French Revolution, that of the many they've had, were about very important political figures. Like, when your dad was exiled from Italy, he was actually a fairly important political figure. You're not.
But yeah, I think at this point it's where we have to acknowledge Birgit Hammer, whose name I can't say. If I was ever in some sort of accident or anything like this, I'd want somebody like that in my corner.
Yeah, and she's not, she's just a person. Like, she's not, because obviously she's Dirk's sister. She's not a lawyer. She's not like come from this background of like casually fighting for the innocent man. She's just like, no, I am going to single-handedly fight my brother's corner because he can't do it.
Yeah. I mean, she quit her job. She moved to different countries at parts of this. She would, in her spare time, she would go around newsrooms and try and get people to put her brother's story in their newspapers. And it took 13 years before it reached court.
Yeah, I think I would definitely be like, okay, my brother's dead. I think this guy did it. No one believes me. I'll just have to move on.
Yeah. But yeah, so it took 13 years, but eventually in 1991, a trial began in the Paris Court of Assizes. And there's a very, again, overly dramatic bit from one of Vittorio's interviews where he talked about how, as he was going into the court, he realized he had these old handcuffs that they put on him. And he realized that the building that he was in was the place where Louis XVI was guillotined. And he was looking at the handcuffs, thinking, are these the handcuffs that they put on Louis XVI? It's what makes it so hard to be sympathetic towards him.
I just like the concept that after Louis the 16th was a guillotine, they were like, get those handcuffs back, we might need them in the future for a minor royal from Italy.
I know, it's
Like,
so
I don't know
funny.
how long handcuffs last, but I feel like they get replaced fairly regularly.
So yeah, he went to trial, and there were a few different things that happened during the course of the trial that made it difficult. So one thing was disappearing evidence. So lots of things disappeared, sort of examples of bullet fragments, which you would have thought you would be able to use to compare to the wound and sort out if it was Vittorio's gun or not. That disappeared. The declaration of liability that Vittorio had signed when he was initially in prison, that miraculously disappeared from evidence.
It's incredibly suspicious. And if I was a conspiracy theorist on either side of this, I would be like,
Yeah.
in that case, whatever you say is wrong.
Yeah. The third thing I'll just quickly say was the witnesses. So there were many people who were on the boat that day who were never called as witnesses and have said that they were never asked to speak in court. There were a few who were there who had been on the boat, but all of them were in their cabins and saw nothing. So when they were asked the question, did you see Vittorio shoot? They all said no because they hadn't seen him. Whereas Vittorio's lawyer pulled out a parade of every high-profile person in France who was a character witness for Vittorio about how he was the nicest guy in the universe. None of them actually were there. And also his lawyer was a monarchist who bowed to him as he walked into the court.
If I ever get arrested for murder, I want someone just to bow to me casually. I'll be like, just as a thing, can we do this, please? Thanks.
Exactly. And so one of the people that he did produce was like the doctor who initially treated Dirk. And the doctor said that what he'd seen wasn't the right bullet wound for the gun that Vittorio had had. But I think nowadays we've got CSI. And so I would know that that doctor is not a ballistics expert. So after a 3-day trial, Vittorio was acquitted of the homicide and he was found guilty of the illegal possession of the firearm. It sounds ludicrous. And I think when you think about it, there was another gun that was on board and they didn't get the missing evidence. You can't judge a court case based on evidence that isn't presented to you. And so their view was that they couldn't be sure that it was his, they knew that he'd fired a gun, but they couldn't be sure that it was his bullet that had killed Dirk. It sounds horrible, and you know, but I can understand why they came to the conclusion that they did based on the evidence that was presented to them. The issue really was in the handling of the evidence. But there's that famous quote about never ascribe to malice that which can be explained by incompetence. And it basically just means that if there's a situation, don't assume that there's some sort of deliberate conspiracy theory, and that, you know, everyone is setting out deliberately to try and do this, when in a lot of cases it's just because people are bad at their jobs or they're stupid. And so I think that it's very possible that there was this like multi-level international conspiracy theory to get rid of evidence, and which is kind of what Birgit and her friends have alleged. But I think that's it might be just, you know, in one case somebody leaned on somebody else to get rid of something, but in another case it was just somebody who mishandled something, or the incompetence of the police, or the lack of communication between the police forces and the courts in different countries.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we look at this court case from the view of being 30 years in the future and looking at it as Vittorio Emanuele as the whole person and everything he did in his life. And I think, you know, something that bothers me a lot when we talk about court cases now and like crimes and, you know, the amount of prejudice there is in with social media, and how that can completely sort of ruin court cases. And I think if you do strip it back to the bare bones of the court case, maybe, you know, they did find him guilty of having the weapon and of firing the weapon, which is what the evidence was, and they didn't find him guilty of the in sort of an unintentional homicide, which actually maybe they could say, well, we can't be sure that there wasn't someone else, which is what their job is there to do.
Yeah, there's a big point that's made around this story of sort of like highlighting what you can do if you have money and you have power. And that makes an assumption that there was some sort of conspiracy theory and the evidence was hidden. And maybe that did happen. I think this is where we go back to kind of the story that I mentioned earlier of Alfonso. You know, at 19 years old, Vittoria witnessed somebody shoot somebody else. And it was all sort of hidden away and you know, put under the carpet by powerful people around the royal family. So, you know, Vittorio has seen that model happen at a relatively young age. And, you know, so it does open up this conversation about sort of inequalities in the justice system. And I think that's really important. But I think that, you know, when it comes to things like him putting forward this other defense of the other shooter, there are a lot of situations where people will have a court-mandated lawyer who just wants to close the case as quickly as possible and tells them to say that they're guilty, or doesn't put forward a very good defense. And that is an inequality, and that is something that needs to be addressed. But I don't think the way do we do that is by lowering the quality of the defense that a rich person gets. I think it's by raising the quality of defense that everybody gets.
Activists nowadays who are from perhaps places where, you know, who are the people suffering, the activists who are actually suffering, and talking about things that you talk about, they say a lot that a lot of modern activism and left-wing liberal activism is focused on anger towards the people who are getting the right thing rather than towards making sure the people who aren't get the right thing. And I think that's something, it's the same situation. Like,
And doesn't it also talk about Charles's health? That relates really strongly to Charles's health stuff as well, funnily enough.
yeah, like you can say what you. I don't think the answer to Charles getting treatment within days of being diagnosed is that he shouldn't have got the treatment. Is that we need to do something to make sure that everyone else is getting the same treatment he is.
Nothing really happened after that. He'd been acquitted. Things kind of calmed down a little bit. In 2002, he was allowed to return to Italy. And then in 2006, in Italy, he was arrested again, this time for a conspiracy to commit bribery and sex trafficking. And that's a whole separate story. I could go into that, but that is a whole separate story as to how that happened. He was eventually acquitted for it, but that's, you know, that's a different episode. The second worst scandal of Vittorio Emanuele. But while he was in jail, the important thing, the thing that relates to Dirk Hammer, is that while he was in jail, he was filmed talking to his cellmate. And on this film, he admits to killing Dirk and boasts about the fact that he managed to fool the French judges. And so initially, when this story came out, it was just the press reporting on transcripts. So yet again, the wonderful Birgit spent 5 years going every legal avenue she could to try and get this tape released. in full so that they could see in full what he had said. And she was successful eventually after 5 years. The tape was released and it revealed in full that he did say he was guilty. He mimed carrying out the shooting and where he'd shot. He describes in detail what happened and then, says that he fooled the French judges.
It is in for Brigitte, it is the biggest sort of stroke of luck to have someone confessing on tape to your brother's murder. And it also shows the arrogance of Vittorio Emmanuel to think that he could just confess to a murder while in prison and being investigated and just assume that would be fine. Like, police informants are a thing, guys.
Yeah, so his defense was like he was tired. He was really tired in prison and he was on medication. And so he, wasn't aware of what he was saying. But then he said, oh, no, but I actually don't remember saying anything. And I don't think I did say it at all. I think this entire thing is made up somehow and sort of fabricated. So I definitely didn't say it. And then he also said that he's never actually seen the footage anyway. So how can you know that it was made up if you've never watched it?
You can watch it. He did
Yeah,
say it.
he did
It
say
was
it.
not edited, you
No.
know.
His defense could have been, and it wouldn't have been fantastic, but it could have been, if I was in that situation, I would have said, like, I was scared in prison. I wanted to seem like a big, tough guy. So I made up a story. And I'm really sorry that I did it at the expense of Dirk Hammer's family.
Maybe his lawyer was just like, not paid my last bill, so I'm just gonna
Yeah, just going to give him terrible advice.
go with this one.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just not the right way to go about it, Vittorio Emmanuel.
No. But despite the footage being released, it didn't change the facts of the fact that he was acquitted. It didn't reopen the case. There's sort of double jeopardy, I guess, in France as well. And so they would need something very substantial. As he died legally being innocent of Dirk Hammer's death. However, the final sort of twist in the tale is that this story, the video, was published in full by Beatrice Borromeo in a newspaper in Italy. So Beatrice Borromeo is the wife of Pierre Casiraghi, who is the son of Princess Caroline of Monaco, grandson of Grace Kelly and Prince Rainier. And her mother is best friends with Brigitte Hammer. So she was part with, because she had these close connections to Brigitte, she was able to get access to the tape through Brigitte and was able to publish that in the Italian newspapers. And remarkably, Vittorio sued them, sued Beatrice, sued the newspaper for defamation. I think also invasion of privacy.
It's that arrogance again.
Yep, that arrogance again. But in 2015, happily, they won, the Beatrice in the newspaper. She did then produce a documentary about this, which I think I'll post a link to because I watched the whole thing. So that was sort of a final coda to the situation. But I mean, this was a s saga that kind of lasted almost 50 years, really. It kind of, with Vittorio's death, I suppose it draws to a close because we'll probably never know exactly what happened. He'll never have an opportunity to change his mind. He'll never be retried.
The facts of the case at its sort of bare bones are that in 1978, two shots were fired. One of them hit Dirk Hammer, who later died as a result. And in 2006, Vittorio Emmanuel said he did it. Whether or not he did do it, you can make as many sort of cases for or against as you like. I mean, I'm sure everyone has an opinion. I'm sure we both have an opinion. I mean, he's dead. I'll say he did it.
He did it. Yep. Yep.
But I think, you know, unless this mysterious other person who stood in Dirk Hammer's exact, not Dirk Hammer's, in a Vittorio Emmanuel's exact position and shot Dirk Hammer arises and is like, oh yeah, I did do that and here's all the evidence. I think, you know, the logical assumption is that Vittorio Emmanuel did shoot Dirk Hammer and then got away with it for the rest of his life, essentially.
Yeah. Some of the narrative around it kind of obscures the facts of the situation. So you have on, and I don't blame anybody involved in this, as that's the point I want to make, is that, on the one hand, you've got Brigitte and her family and her friends kind of as very much advancing this conspiracy theory narrative. And there might be some truth in that. There might be some exaggeration in that, but I totally understand why they're putting that case forward. And then on the other side, you have Vittorio, who is advancing his own conspiracy theory. And there might be some truth in that. There might not be. But I think that if I was in either of their shoes, I would be doing the same thing. I don't want to go to prison for life. And I also don't want my brother's or my family member's killer to go without punishment for what he did. So I understand the perspectives of everybody in this situation, but I think that it's just, I mean, just if you think about it, just logically, on a logical basis, he went with a gun, but he knew what could happen. I just think it's very far-fetched. So, you know, it's become this sort of big international conspiracy theory, and I think really at the end of it's just a really sad situation where somebody made a lot of choices that led to somebody completely innocent dying, and you know, they could have made other choices.
Yeah, I think it's like you said, it's so coloured by the fact that it's got these kind of exiled ex-royals in it, because otherwise it's a fairly, you wouldn't be quite as into it. Not that you wouldn't be into it, but it wouldn't be quite as convoluted, because you'd be like, well, someone shot someone, but you've got this sort of whole added element of, is it a anti-Italian thing? Is it against the, is it like a republicanism thing? A lot of the things were tried in France, and you know, France are quite famously republican. I think, you know, like we, I said earlier on, we look at this through the lens of everything else Victorian Emmanuel did, but we are looking at it through that lens, and everything else he did suggests he was quite a horrible person. So it's not hard to assume that as part of the horrible things he did in his life, he had a gun which he shot that killed someone. But Brigitte spent so long sort of fighting for justice, and even though she never got the justice for her brother in term legally, I think possibly the public opinion, she has.
So, thank you for joining us for this episode today, where we talked about two wildly different stories, which actually ended up having some similarities. But other than that, it is a goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.